Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the winner of the 2011 Templeton Prize shares some insights into the future of the universe and the origins of our life on Earth. And the chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy to the Holy See looks back at the history of those diplomatic relations and the impact of Pope Benedict's recent visit to the UK in September 2010. The 2011 Templeton Prize was awarded on Wednesday to leading astrophysicist Sir Martin Rees, a former president of Britain's prestigious Royal Society. In announcing the £1 million prize, a statement from the US-based Templeton Foundation said Rees's work over many decades has enlarged the boundaries of understanding about the physical processes that define the cosmos. Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, a member of the House of Lords and of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, author of numerous books and lectures exploring the origins and future of our universe, Rees has focused his work on the implications of the Big Bang, the nature of black holes, and the explosions from galaxy centres known as gamma ray bursters. Raised in the Church of England, Rees says he has no religious beliefs, yet his insights have helped to shape some of the crucial theological and philosophical questions at the heart of our human existence. Keen to find out more about his views on the relationship between faith and science, I caught up with him and began by asking for his reactions when he found out he'd been awarded this prestigious prize.
Well, obviously I was delighted, but I was very surprised because I wasn't really convinced that I would tick the boxes that are needed for eligibility, because I am primarily a scientist who has worked on some of the social implications of science.
You've spent your career really exploring what you call the big questions, haven't you, about the origins and the dimensions of the cosmos and about the role of human life within this.
That's right. My specialist interest is astronomy and cosmology, and for 30 or 40 years, I've been privileged to take part in a very exciting intellectual quest where we've understood far more clearly about the nature of the objects in the universe. But of course, as always, the more you learn, the more new questions come into focus. So we still have mysteries which we are tackling now. And of course, some of these problems are of broad interest beyond science, particularly for philosophy and religion.
What was it, first of all, that attracted you to this kind of exploration of time and space, if you like?
Well, I studied mathematics and physics at university and wanted to seek some context in which I could make use of these skills in a subject that was advancing fast and had broad conceptual horizons. And I was rather lucky, actually, in that I started this subject in the late 1960s when there were exciting developments, the first evidence for the Big Bang, the first evidence for black holes, etc. But what's been even more fortunate is that the pace has not slowed down at all. And if I look at what's happened in the last few years, that's been as exciting as any previous period. In particular, we've not only understood a good deal more about the very early stages of the universe, but we have glimmerings that our universe is vastly larger even than we thought before. And also, in a quite different area of astronomy, we've for the first time got good evidence that many stars are orbited by planets, just as our sun is orbited by the Earth and the other planets we're familiar with. So the night sky is becoming much, much more interesting.
Of course, a lot of this scientific research is pretty incomprehensible to most ordinary people, and yet you believe the questions it raises do and should concern us all. It's not always easy to separate, though, is it, the sort of scary science fiction from real scientific progress? Do you think people are generally more interested and perhaps more educated about these issues than they were when you began your work?
I think they are. It's very important that scientists should emphasize clearly when they are saying something with fair confidence and when they're saying something which is very speculative and uncertain. But I do believe that it's possible to explain the key ideas of science free of technicalities. obviously, we specialists have to go into the maths and the details, but I think the key ideas can be understood by anyone, and it's part of the pleasure of my role as a professor of astronomy that I feel I can explain what we discover in a manner that's interesting to a wide audience. I think people like to know that there are many other planets orbiting other stars. They like to know that there was a beginning to our expanding universe nearly 14 billion years ago. They like to know what the future holds, etc. And so I feel I'm fortunate, and I do believe that these ideas can be conveyed in non-technical language.
You don't see it as dumbing down at all? There's no risk of making it oversimplified, in a sense?
Well, I don't think so. There are some subjects which are conceptually hard, but I think astronomy is a lot easier to convey than, for instance, subatomic physics, which is very far from what people are used to thinking about. Everyone has gazed up at the stars. Indeed, the night sky is perhaps the feature of our environment which is most common to all humanity, because throughout all the ages people have looked up at the sky and interpreted it in their own way and wondered about it. And we can answer questions about it that couldn't be answered in the past, and these questions actually deepen the mystery and the wonder and make it more fascinating and complex.
You talked about not ticking all the boxes. Now, you stress that you have no religious beliefs as such, but that you are, quote, a product of the Christian culture and ethics of the Anglican church that you were raised in. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I certainly was brought up in a conventional English background. I went to a school where we all went to chapel, etc. And I've become very influenced by that culture, and I hugely value the aesthetic and musical traditions of the Church of England in which I was brought up, and I am a supporter of the Church of England as an institution. I think we're especially fortunate that the two archbishops, John Centenu and Rowan Williams, people of utterly different cast of mind, are both remarkable individuals who greatly raise the standard of public debate in the UK. So I'm proud to be a supporter, even if not a believer, in this church.
Would you say it was perhaps the scientific research that you were engaged in that led you to reject a faith as such, a religious belief of your own, or not?
Oh, not at all. I think it's clear that among my colleagues there are people who have a variety of beliefs. So I don't really think that there's any incompatibility between science and belief. I mean, obviously, one can't believe in naive creationism if one is a scientist, but there are many cosmologists who are conventional believers. I'm just not among them.
Do you ever come into conflict, though, with church leaders who feel threatened by your work? I mean, you had a highly acclaimed early paper, didn't you, called The Collapse of the Universe, an Eschatological Study, which is a term more often heard in theological circles.
Yes, I'm glad that some of the topics I work on are of philosophical interest, and I think it is important that theologians do take on board what we are learning, not just in my own subject, but obviously in the biology and other subjects, because their view of the world has to embrace what we are learning scientifically. But of course, we know very well that many of the things that humans care about can't be answered just by science.
There are also plenty of scientists, though, who believe that faith in a creator God is simply incompatible with scientific knowledge, or at the very best, that religion should be confined to the private sphere. Do you think it has a place in the public debate today?
Well, I think there are a whole range of issues which are complicated ethically and complicated politically, and I think it's very important that the churches play a constructive role. As I mentioned, the two leaders of the Church of England are, I believe, being very constructive in this regard. I think it's really very important that we try and stimulate a public debate which is less parochial and less short-sighted. And I think perhaps scientists like myself can perhaps help by focusing on the kind of problems which we confront globally and which are going to affect the world in the coming decade, problems of resources, conserving the environment, energy, etc., because politicians tend, obviously, to focus on the urgent rather than the long-term and important. And I think we scientists perhaps can help along with religious leaders and others, to ensure that there is a broader perspective and that we don't neglect what the world would be like for our children and grandchildren.
It's true, isn't it, that despite our huge increase in knowledge about what you describe as the fragile pale blue dot of our Earth, and yet we are unable to make really sensible decisions about sharing resources and safeguarding the Earth for future generations. What would be your message in this sense to government leaders as well? You're a member of the House of Lords too, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And I think, indeed, there is a contrast between what science would allow us to do and what is actually happening. I mean, I'm a technical optimist, and I believe that we have or soon will have the capability to provide a good life for all the world's population. And that population will, of course, be higher by 2050 than it is today. But, of course, the gap between what we could do and what we are doing is getting ever more worrying. So although I'm a technical optimist, I'm rather a political pessimist, although I think we must strive hard to ensure that the benefits of globalization are fairly shared and to ensure that the science which we have learned is applied for the benefit of the developing as well as the developed world.
As you say, you believe that although technology is a good thing, our human ability to manage its consequences is very limited, and that there will be some kind of either man-made disaster or deliberate technological terror attack. It's almost inevitable, you think, don't you, within the next few decades?
I think we're going to have a bumpy ride through this century, and I think we'd be very lucky indeed if we avoid some severe setbacks stemming from two things. The first is the growing impact that we are collectively having on the planet, because the more of us, each of us more demanding of energy and resources. And secondly, technology is empowering individuals and small groups. And in our ever more interconnected and networked world, it's easier for a small group to cause disruption. And I think to cope with these two concerns is going to be a challenge to our politicians. But I think by raising awareness of these, one can perhaps help to minimize the risk of these downsides. But of course, the main problem is that we are going to have a growing population, at least until 2050. But I hope very much that after that time, the population will gradually decline, because all the problems facing the world are aggravated by a growing population.
One of the most thought-provoking areas that you work on is whether the universe could in fact be just one of many other similar places. You call it an archipelago of cosmoses, don't you, that could sustain other types of life that are more or less complex than our own. Again, this is a discovery that could profoundly affect religious beliefs as well as the way we view ourselves and our world. Do you think that we will have the answer to this question within a generation or so?
Well, I don't know. I think cosmology is a story of expanding horizons. I mean, centuries ago, people thought the solar system was all there is and the stars were just painted on the vault of heaven, as it were. Then we realized that we were in a galaxy. Then we realized that our galaxy was one of billions visible through a large telescope. And what I suspect is that we may have to enlarge our horizons still more and realize that there's a lot more to physical reality than the huge domain we can observe with our telescopes. There may even be other big bangs apart from our own. And this, of course, does have philosophical implications. In particular, it means that what we think of as the fundamental universal laws of nature may, in this grander perspective, be just, as it were, bylaws in our cosmic patch. And the entire universe may be far larger than what we've traditionally called the universe, and may be governed by a whole range of different laws. And this is something which is fascinating to scientists. It's a challenge, and I'm not sure how likely they are to solve these questions this century, but it certainly is something which has great philosophical implications.
My thanks there to Martin Rees, recipient of the 2011 Templeton Prize. April 1982 marked the restoration of full diplomatic relations between the United Kingdom and the Holy See, following a break of over 400 years. Ambassador Sir Mark Heath presented his credentials on April 1, 1982, just a few months ahead of Pope John Paul II's historic visit to Britain, the first pope to travel there and mark a significant milestone on the road to post-Reformation reconciliation. But the history of UK-Holy See relations goes back to the days before the Reformation and the founding of the Church of England, right back to 1479, when King Edward IV appointed the first resident ambassador to the Vatican. But that relationship didn't last long. In fact, it was broken off just half a century later.
They were broken off under Henry VIII, restored under Mary, and then broken off again under Queen Elizabeth I. And it was then rather a long time until formal relations were re-established.
George Edgar is chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy to the Holy See. He came to Vatican Radio to tell us more about the history of those diplomatic relations and the impact of Pope Benedict's recent visit to the UK in September last year.
It was in 1914, just after the outbreak of the First World War, that formal relations were re-established.
Do you know the reason behind that at that time? As you say, it was just around the outbreak of World War One.
I think it was very much in connection with the outbreak of the war that the British government felt it was important to be close to the Holy See at that point, given the influence of the Pope and of the Holy See in international affairs. And the difficult stage of European history, it was felt important to be present and to be able to deal directly with the Pope and with the Curia.
Although it was still quite a difficult time for Anglican-Catholic relations, wasn't it? And it was obligatory for the ambassador to be an Anglican at that time, something which continued pretty much up until the days of your predecessor.
That's right. Francis Campbell was, as I think is well known, was the first Catholic to be appointed to the job of ambassador to the Holy See, or indeed head of our representation to the Holy See in recent times. So yes, that was an issue. But I think the purpose of the mission from 1914, as indeed now, is very much primarily focused on government-to-government relations rather than church-church relations. The Anglican Church manages very effectively its own relationship with the Catholic Church.
Full relations then were restored, as we said, in April 1982, just ahead of the first ever papal visit to Britain, John Paul II's historic visit in the summer of 1982. How important was that, do you think? What kind of event was it, the restoration of relations, first of all?
It was in a way important primarily symbolically because there was already an effective diplomatic relationship, and indeed it was the same person, Mark Heath, who moved from being minister to being ambassador. So it didn't fundamentally change the day-to-day workings of the mission, but what it meant was that we were restoring to a full level of diplomatic relations. And I think it was a reflection of the way in which the relationship had developed. It was a reflection of a very healthy relationship between the British government and the Holy See. And again, as you've suggested, it was looking forward to Pope John Paul's visit, which was the first ever visit by a pope to Britain, and therefore a hugely important event in the relationship.
The first ambassador, as you say, Mark Heath, presented his credentials, and as he spoke to the Pope, the issues on the agenda then were Poland, the situation in Eastern Europe, still under communist rule, and Northern Ireland was another critical issue that they were looking at together. Now, both of those, in some sense, have been resolved, we could say. What would you say are the key issues, the critical issues, where the UK government and the Holy See are working together today?
I'd say there are essentially two sets of international issues. We have a great interest in keeping close to the thinking of the Vatican about regional issues. For example, the kind of things which are going on in North Africa at the moment, or the difficulties in Côte d'Ivoire, to which Pope Benedict XVI has sent an envoy, has sent Cardinal Turkson as his envoy. So there's an interest in those issues on the part of the Holy See. There's an interest on our part. I think from both sides that there's useful information to share, and value in combining our influence where we can. Then there are the broader international issues. We have a very good relationship on a number of development issues, partly through the work that the British Department for International Development does directly with the UK-based Catholic aid organisations. But then more generally, we have very useful discussions both with the Secretariat in the Vatican and with the other organisations such as the Council for Justice and Peace, which handle the policy side of these issues. So we're keen to continue those discussions and then to work together on other big global issues, whether that's human rights or climate change, for example.
And you're working, as you say, along a range of broad range of different issues, aren't you? From nuclear deterrence, for example, to immunisation in Africa. Can you give us perhaps an idea, a flavour of some of the different subjects that you'll be looking at over the course of your work?
Well, you've mentioned two very important ones, and both the Holy See and the Catholic Church in a number of countries, including the UK, had, for example, a very influential role in the work that's been done up to now towards establishment of an international arms trade treaty. That's something that's very close to the heart of the British government as well, and something we'll want to continue working on together. Then, as I mentioned, climate change is another issue on which Pope Benedict XVI has made clear his concern. It was something that was highlighted in a message that he issued ahead of the Copenhagen meeting on climate change the year before last. And it's something on which the Vatican continues to work. I attended, for example, a fascinating conference at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences on mountain glaciers, which may sound quite specialised, but actually the fate of mountain glaciers is something that really illustrates the kind of problems we face in terms of the impacts of climate change, how we work to reduce those impacts and how we adapt to the impacts that are inevitable. So I think that the Holy See has a great deal to contribute on issues of that kind, and we're therefore very keen, in the sense that we share goals and we share ambitions in those areas, we're very keen to work together with them.
The development agencies, the NGOs in Britain and indeed in many other countries are keen to put this right at the top of the political agenda, climate change and its impact on development particularly. Can we call it a priority for the British government at the moment?
Absolutely, yes. It's a priority both in its own terms, as an issue that has to be faced, that the world has to face up to. It's a priority, as you say, also because it impacts on development. And the British government has made very clear that we feel that more needs to be done, for example, to implement the Millennium Development Goals. We were a very keen participant in the summit last year, which took place just after Pope Benedict's visit to the UK, the summit in New York to review where we've got to so far on the Millennium Development Goals. And while there's been good progress on some of them, there are others where we really have a very long way to go. And that's something we feel is an obligation on the part of the developed countries to work with developing countries to achieve those. And it's something where climate change can have a very negative effect in terms of its impact on poverty, on hunger and so on.
Let's look back at Pope Benedict's visit to the UK in September 2010. You were very involved, weren't you, as head of the papal visit team concerned with the political issues on the agenda?
That's right. I came in May last year to head up, really to establish and then to head up a team which was primarily looking at the policy aspects. My colleagues in the Foreign Office's Protocol Directorate dealt with the very complicated logistics of the visit, and I looked more at the policy side.
The months leading up to the visit were difficult, weren't they? There was a lot of concern about how well this visit would go.
There was. There was a lot of negative comment in the media and a feeling at various times that we had a big uphill struggle to make sure that things did work. But working very closely together with the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales and the Scottish Bishops' Conference, we made sure that the right arrangements were in place for all the events. I think the programme, as it ended up, was an excellent one. And I say that's having inherited a lot of it from those who were involved before I was. And the way that Pope Benedict XVI himself came across once he arrived in the UK I think, helped to dissolve a lot of those doubts that had been there before. He made a very powerful impression. And it's an indication of that that the police estimated that over 500,000 people in the UK either attended the big pastoral events or came to see Pope Benedict as he travelled through Edinburgh, Glasgow, London and Birmingham. And I think some of the speeches that he made, particularly the speech to civil society in Westminster Hall, also made a very powerful impression. Partly that was the Pope's willingness to address very directly difficult topics. Partly it was the very profound comments on the role of faith in society. And then on top of that, the speech in Westminster Hall addressed in a powerful way some very specific issues around international development.
Many people talk about the sight of the Vatican flags alongside the Union Jack going down the Mall, something which they see as a real turning point in the history of British relations with the Holy See. Do you agree with that? Do you think it really has had a huge impact, something of a turning point, can we say, even in the attitude of the government towards the Church and towards the Holy See?
I'd say, to be honest, less of a turning point than of a confirmation, an affirmation of something which really had been developing over a long period. As we've already talked about, the restoration of full diplomatic relations came 28 years earlier. So this was something which really marks the end of a long process rather than a sudden shift, I think. But it is very much an indication of complete normality of relations. And going further than that, of a very warm and mutually comfortable and happy relationship.
Certainly David Cameron's address to the Pope made it seem that all was well, that the government was very keen on working even more closely together. And yet there are still significant areas of difference. How much do you think perhaps this visit will continue to influence the way the government is keen to work with the Church, also the Catholic Church in the UK, as well as with the Holy See?
Well, we certainly very much intend to continue to work closely both with the Holy See and in the UK with the Catholic Church and with Catholic organisations. As I mentioned, there's a very good relationship between DFID and the UK-based Catholic aid organisations. Yes, there are issues on which we take a different approach. I think those are issues that we're comfortable discussing between ourselves. That will no doubt continue to be the case, but that's the case with every bilateral relationship. So I don't think that's something which we should be excessively sensitive about. And as I say, the discussions that took place during the visit, and particularly perhaps the discussions at the dinner which was hosted by the Foreign Secretary for the delegation that came with Pope Benedict, that was an opportunity for discussion of a whole range of areas where we can work well together. Some of those international, the ones I've already mentioned, but then also domestic issues, for example, the role of the Church and of faiths more widely in education, the contribution that can be made by faith groups and by the churches to the big society agenda. There was a whole range of areas where we felt, coming out of those discussions, that we can work well together.
My thanks there to George Edgar, chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy to the Holy See. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.